Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everybody. This is Kevin Boileau, Nazarita Goldhammer. It is, what is the day today? It's November 27th. We're heading towards the end of the year. And it occurred to me that this is the season where people spend an awful lot of money buying things. And so we thought we'd talk about, Nazarita and I thought we'd talk about stuff, we'd talk about things. I'll just set the stage a little bit. So I've learned as a professor and a phenomenologist that our stuff has a profound impact on our mind space, has a profound impact on our noosphere, in other words, the realm of the mind. And so it's good to pay attention to that, if that's true. And I'm thinking about all of the items that people accumulate in their houses. I'm thinking about how people express love through giving stuff. And it's come to be, I think, expected in many households in the West that holidays mean stuff. They mean items, consumer items. Usually they have a trick to them in some way. It's a sizzle. It's what I call a goodie. There's a lot of goodies in life. But a lot of times those goodies are mirage and illusion. They take the place of something else. They stand in for their signifiers. So some children from wealthier backgrounds expect wealthier gifts, international trips, fancy clothes, spending money for restaurants, cars, bikes, computer gear, and so this, to me, this begs the question of the difference between a need and a preference. A need and a preference. But I think we've confused the two. What do we really need? What makes our life work? I'm hearing more and more reports. I read them and I hear them on media channels where people are almost across the board expressing a greater happiness, a greater range of freedom by having fewer items. And I mean fewer numbers of items. If you take the total number of items and they reduce it by 90%, they're often happier. It doesn't mean they're living in a ditch, but it means that there's a lot that gets lost in items. On the other hand, to be fair and balanced, it's true that some items are very beautiful, some items are very functional. They help us live the lives that we want to live. And so there's a balance. I'm thinking about, this is more tongue-in-cheek, but I'm thinking about my elderly mother who fairly recently went through all of her clothing and found clothes with tags on them from when she was in her 20s. So this is, 60 to 65 years ago. Tags still on these clothes. But she had to lug them around because she told me, she said, well, I might wear it someday. So here we are in this season of things and stuff, and it makes me think, in a really honest, down-to-earth way, what's important? What is an important gift? What is the meaning of a thing? So, like I said, to be fair and balanced, some things really, really, truly enhance your life. They really do. I probably don't need 5 cars or 5 guitars or 5 coffee makers or 5 printers, you know. And so we're, there's this, we've hit this new level in consumer society where people are just stacking stuff. They're stacking it in their homes, their garages, storage units. A lot of it gets thrown out, and it ends up in third world countries who we pay, who the United States pays to take our garbage. And these are places full of misery, toxicity, because we've exploited them. These items don't magically disappear. They go somewhere, and the earth is a finite unit. So let's talk about things. Let's talk about stuff. Let's talk about how the holidays are coming. And let's talk about expectations about things. Let's talk about gifts. Let's talk about the difference between a need and a preference. Welcome to the show, Nazarita. We'd love to hear what you have to say.
Thank you. I love this topic. And I love this topic because as someone who loves to design interiors, I love to see beauty and function and harmony married together to create a place that is totally enjoyable and inspirational. That being said, most people don't actually look at their stuff in their interiors. They actually just don't even look at them. And I think most people find out when they start to move, let's say they buy a new house or they change houses or apartments or condos, they start to find all the things that have been hidden in their closets, in their drawers, and they say, wow, look at this. You know, I forgot I had this. This is really good. I need this. And so I've designed interiors. I designed interiors for a long time. And what I found with most people is they didn't want something that was really authentic to themselves. They wanted something that was a showcase so that people actually thought that they looked, that they were better than what they perceived themselves to be. So you know, you have Marie Kondo, and you have Helen Sanderson. She's a psychologist who does help people with clutter and getting things in order. Marie Kondo makes us aware of, like, to appreciate each thing, whether we give it up or whether we keep it, but to look at that stuff as having an energy that we're grateful for when we give it away, and that we utilize it if we have it. I think that this is really important because I know people's homes, and I'm just thinking of that because that includes all kinds of clothing items, and it includes stuff that we keep around all the time that was collected over the years or that we've purchased, and people often buy new things all the time. And the reason why they do is because they want to be seen as someone who is progressive, has new things. They want to be seen in a certain light to other people. Because people who go to other people's houses, if you have friends, family who come to your house, they feel very free to comment on your house. Oh, I don't like that paint color. That paint color is really, really odd. You know, are you going to change it? And they point out these things all the time. We as humans are very verbose in how we view other people and their belongings and things. We often make comments that are derogatory, that are belittling, and that show an opinion that has no, it doesn't relate to who the person really is. And that's why a lot of new places have a showroom feel. This is what you get. It's devoid of any emotion, feeling. It's just a set kind of what's perceived as beauty. But, you know, it uses animal products. It's like chemicals, a lot of things that are contained in sofas and beds and that emit lots of chemicals. And people don't seem to care about that. They just want it to look a certain way. But I'll give you one thought on clothes. And because I've actually thought about this. Clothes seem to accumulate in closets seemingly without our awareness, like hidden in the night. They kind of multiply. But if you had we'll just a lot for a month being uneven, if you had 30 pieces of clothing, like shirts or sweaters, and you wore each of them 30 pieces once a month, that means that you would wear each piece 12 times. Seems like that's not a very lot. It seems like that is just not a whole lot of wearing 12 times a year. And I know people have events that they have to go to that they wear certain things only one time a year, you know, put on their party dress or their tux or suit. For a wedding or a funeral, and those things only get worn a certain amount. But that still can account for very few pieces of clothing. And I just found that whole idea of math so interesting in terms of I just took the top layer. I just took, you know, blouses, sweaters, things like that. And I know people will say, well, we need winter clothes and summer clothes and spring clothes and fall clothes. But still, if you even look at that, how often you actually wear something, you can cut down your clothing expenditure a lot. Take shoes, for instance. I mean, if you wear a gorgeous pair of shoes one time a month, and, you know, some people have a lot of shoes. They like a lot of shoes, but they don't wear them a lot. They wear them for something. They contain meaning. They're not because they're comfortable a lot or that it's because they hold a meaning. And that meaning could be it makes others think of them as sexual beings. It makes others think that they are more attractive. It makes others think that they are taller or that they can afford more. All these things, stuff that we're talking about, is connected to what others think of us. And that's really the heart of what we're really talking about, like what is enough, right? What is enough?
Yeah, that is it. What is enough? You know, the other thing is we have, I don't want to belittle this point either, we have sign systems in every culture, sign systems. And so that means every item is a signifier. It signifies something. And sometimes in complex ways and sometimes very simple ways. So, for example, stop sign signals stop. That's a safety issue. But if you take that and you make think about the complexity of the way people dress, what they wear, how they do their hair, shoes, how they walk, their sign systems, they carry a lot of meaning. And we can tell a lot by that meaning. We can tell a lot about our culture. These are communications from ourselves to the world. everything that a person wears, and this is true of everybody, it's not the case that there are items without signification. That would be false. And so what it means is that you can read a lot. It's kind of like discourse analysis, but it's more like analyzing sign systems within a culture depending upon things. You know, so if somebody's driving a $400,000 Mercedes-Benz car, that says something a little bit different than a person driving, you know, a $20,000 Kia car. They say different things. Colors say different things. Labels say different things. So there is a sign system, and what, and it's not even to the point of a hypothesis yet in my mind, but what's interesting is that you could live, you could strip down your living to the simplest possible level. This is just a thought experiment. This is not suggesting anybody do this, thought experiment. And then you could talk to a person who does this, and you could trace the use value of every item they have. A lot of times people who live in smaller spaces do this. Everything is the functionality issue on a functionality index, I think, goes way up. Just because you have to have higher levels of functionality in a 500-square-foot living abode as opposed to a 5,000-square-foot living abode. There, you can get away with less functionality in a larger place. So, but in the thought experiment, if you were to strip it down to the simplest level, we'll call that level one, where a person has only the things he or she needs. I mean, each item passes a rigorous scrutiny of, you know, what specific purpose that item serves in that person's life. And you could start with a very small list. We'll call it dimension one, we'll call D1X. X means number of items. And then you look at that, you could have that conversation, and then you could go through that person's belongings and see what they really have. Not just the stuff that they would need at that level one living, but all the other levels, you know, the 1,000 pieces of jewelry, the 800 pairs of pants. Imelda Marcos had something like, 50,000 pairs of shoes, 100,000 pairs of shoes, something like that. But the purpose of the thought experiment is to show us how much unconsciously we are driven by these sign systems through the media. For example, if you look at if you look at teenage girls or women in their early 20s, they're creating their own sign system for women that age, and they're speaking through what they wear. It's a performative, it's a communication act. And then if you compare that with, an elderly man who's 80 years old, so 80-year-old men, what do they wear? Or what sorts of items do they have or do they use in a 7-day week? And I think it's a really interesting exercise. Part of its functionality. And for me, thinking psychoanalytically, part of it is to understand the reason why we buy, why we multiply objects. You know what? I'll give you a prime example of this because it's something that's near and dear to my heart. I have seen, rarely, but I have seen complicated, large kitchens that were meant for super wealthy people who like to cook. And they have every conceivable appliance that money can buy. In fact, I used to know somebody like that who had probably 100 appliances. And I kid you not, probably 100 appliances. Some of them were stored upstairs. Some were stored downstairs. Some of them were in storage units. Some of them were out on the counter. Some of them in closets. And you have to ask yourself, what does that mean to have all, 100 appliances in the kitchen? And I've also seen, on the other side, really gifted chefs, gifted cooks, who could take, 4 or 5 cooking objects, pans, whatnot, and make an extraordinary meal. So in other words, they're finding creative ways to develop functionality within simplicity. But what I find in America, and I realized this after I'd gone to Europe a few times, at least the European people I gravitated towards, that Americans have a tendency to buy more shit than they need. I'm going to put it out there. It's just a tendency. I wouldn't say it's true of everybody, but I would say in large part it's true. So why is that? You know, as a thinking person, I ask, why is that? Why do we do that? And then, Nazarita, you know, I've actually worked with hoarders before, and we know a little bit about hoarding. And this is a case where people become entrapped, enslaved to their things, those items, the stuff. And the stuff starts, I think it devours people. I'm going to use words like becomes the devil. It has a devouring nature. It's an oppression. And then you start going, you go back to school and you start thinking about existential analysis. And part of existential analysis involves the domain of what we'll call the furniture of the universe, materiality, things, and how those things have a counter effect on us. You know, we might ostensibly use them for something, but they also have a counter effect on us, certainly when they're grouped together with others. We become structuralized. And then reading the architect Palasma's work on the phenomenology of structure and how structure says a lot, not only says a lot about who we are, but controls who we are. And that's also, I guess that's a place for me to hand the microphone back to you, Nazarita. I find Palasma's work fascinating, his key insights about how architecture or living space or workspace really, it becomes determinative of the mind space and the heart space within that structure. What do you think about that? I mean, that's really powerful, seems to me.
Yeah, it's really interesting. You know, I had an experience. I've actually had many of these experiences, and they've impacted me greatly, is that to see the difference between the disparity of building, of architecture for the wealthy, as opposed to architecture for, you know, middle-class, poor people. There's three kinds of architecture. The poorest gets these huge buildings in which are these little rooms without adequate ventilation. Nothing is built in. Everything is just box. It's a box, just a box with nothing in it but the very essentials. And in order to have a neat house, you have to find things that you usually find at places that cater to people who have not, I would say, minimal amount of money to people who want to save money, which is, this being said, I love IKEA, Target. But if you really look at them, there's IKEA, Target, Walmart, Costco. These are places that cater to really using inexpensive solutions to an architectural problem. And that architectural problem is there isn't any place to put anything. If you're poor, there isn't any place to put anything in a room. There's hardly any closet. There isn't a place for shoes. There isn't a place for adequate sleeping, putting a dresser in for your clothes. And so what most people end up doing is if they have the money, they go to these places that are mass-produced pieces of furniture, a lot of times made with harmful chemicals and emissions, so that they can store even the essential belongings. Now, as you get to a higher middle class or a wealthy class, you have all the room that you need. And you have exquisite pieces of furniture that fulfill a function. They have these huge closets that can house all your clothes, all your camping, anything that you desire is hidden away nicely, doesn't interfere with your sight, doesn't look like a bunch of junk, is not piled on the floor or in the corner or on the countertop. It is put away. And so there's a disparity. If we really look at this, it's the same in healthcare. The wealthy have everything at their very fingertips that they can afford in healthcare that keeps them healthy. And the very poor struggle to even pay a small bill, and nothing is available to them because it costs money. Same with architecture. I love Palasma. He is trying to reinstill a simpler, more beautiful way of life that is functional. And housing should be functional. Like, there's a lot of old houses that I've seen that have a lot of built-in places, built-in for dishes, built-in for books, built-in, even though they may have a tiny closet. What this represents is it shows us, it's a mirror for what we're buying now that is different than the way things used to be in the early 1900s. So what we're usually buying now is we're buying more clothes. We're buying more things that represent what we want other people to see us as. And so you've seen closets of stars, you've seen their closets are massive, thousands of purses, thousands of pairs of shoes, thousands of pieces of clothing to wear, which they could never even wear all at once. And you brought up a good point of your mom, that kind of lack of thinking that you might not be able to afford anything, so you better keep it because you may be able to wear it and look good. And that's the thing, is that we're caught in this cycle of, like, if we don't keep it, we may never be able to buy it again. And then when we need it, we will be out of luck. There's these two ways of thinking when you're in the middle class, which is you hoard things because they cost money and you only have so much money and you can't afford to buy it again and you might need it someday. And then the opposite is I'm going to do without and suffer. And then when I need it, I'm not going to have it. And I'm going to deteriorate in my health, in ways of being because I don't want it. So there is a pathway to this, but it means, just like you said, looking at these signs and ways that we live to show what we're actually doing. Like, there used to be a book, which I still actually have because it was so impactful to me. And it was done over 20 years ago, but it was how people live. And they went around the world and they took one person's house and they emptied it out into the front lawn. And believe it or not, they could do that. They could do it like in an hour, empty it. And if you look at the disparity around the world, what people have and what they function with is very different than what we are faced with today. Like, I'll give you a great quote. It's from the minimalist, Joshua Becker. They started this movement of minimalism. Like, what do we really need? Now, granted, they are two guys, and guys have a different sense of what is needful. So he said, in psychological theory, the endowment effect is our tendency to consider an object more important than it really is, simply because we own it. This explains why it's so hard for us to get rid of our stuff. Now, There is another book, I don't remember the name of it, but this, again, really impacted me. It was like they gave an audience pens. One group got pens and the other got a cup. And everybody that got a pen complained that they would rather have the cup. And everybody that had the cup, the majority complained that the pen was more functional. And yet, when it came time to exchange, nobody wanted to exchange because they owned it. It was theirs, and they were afraid that
people really have a hard time giving up their stuff, don't they?
Absolutely, but if you own it, you don't want to give it up, right?
I want to go down that rabbit hole. I want to go down it right now on the show because I think it's true. I watch people, friends, family, myself. I think it's true. I think that people have a hard time. I wouldn't say, you know, everything, but I can see that for a lot of things, people have a hard time giving them up. Like you're giving away part of your soul, or you're giving away something that's like super valuable. And I'm going to tell you something that I noticed the last, let's just say in the last 15 years of moving in my life, and I moved a lot in the last 15 years, there were things that I felt emotional about giving up. And looking back, even looking back 6 months prior or a year, like a year out from giving that up, I realized that I didn't need them at all. They stuck to me like glue. And in existential phenomenology, we do call that sedimentation. Ideas can be sedimented, but we can be sedimented by things as well, where we just don't want to give them up. I've known people who've had multiple extremely large storage rooms, commercial storage rooms, because they couldn't give up any one particular thing. You know, and unless you're Abraham Lincoln and you're going to have the Lincoln Library, and you're going to keep every little letter you write, I don't see everything as being that important. And I've, in my own life, I've experienced that. And I think it's a really interesting experience to go through. This period of heart, you know what I mean, where it's hard to give up something, and then you give it up, and you're like, "Well, that was a piece of cake. I didn't really need that after all. That plate, or that pair of shoes, or that picture.
That's true.
I didn't need it at all. Absolutely. It's in a way it's comical."
Here's what they estimate that the average American home has in it now. They estimate that the number of items inside the average American home is about 300,000. Now, this sounds incredible. Unless you've moved. If you've moved and you've actually counted pieces that you're going through in drawers and everything, you can see where this could actually be true. It sounds astounding, but it's true. And that's what I was trying to say is, like, we think that we don't own a lot until we start to move things and start to count those things and say, wow, we have a lot of stuff. You know, I used to have a storage bin, and storage bins are, you see them all over. You see them in little towns everywhere. There are places where people can store their stuff. So in case they need more stuff, they can go get the stuff. In case they move to a bigger place, they have more stuff to get. And so it's kind of ironic, isn't it, that we are so consumed with stuff that it impedes our creativity, and we start to fight and have wars over stuff instead of what is really important to us and the creativity that can come if you have an opening from owning too much stuff.
Right. So let's go back to the meaning question, because I think it's important to sophisticated and intentional design. I think it's important for all of us. I know that some objects, if we have too many of them around, can keep us in the past. I think sometimes if we have too many objects, they can keep us in chaos mentally. And I think humans are really susceptible to that. I really, really, really see it. That we're susceptible And now with the barrage of internet messages, right, the power of the media, which is just, it's on steroids. It is so pervasive and so extreme, you know, telling us what the meaning of things is, what's important, what's valuable, what's good. It's, I would think it'd be enough to cause any random average person a little bit of distress. I don't think anybody's immune. I think we're all susceptible because of this massive barrage of messages that we get socially, culturally, legally, familially. And so on the other side of that, you know, we've listened, both of us together, to many, many reports about people seeking what they call a simpler life. But when you hear them talk about this, what they end up describing is a life that's much more intentional. And I wouldn't actually say it's simpler. I would say it's more intentional. It's more focused. It's more authentic. And that, just even talking about that, Nazareth, it fills my heart with a kind of a joy. It really does. The joy in watching somebody design a living space that really works for them. And you can go A to Z from beginning to back, from the opening of their door, the very back part of their apartment or their small house. They can actually tell you why they painted the wall a certain color, why they used a particular table and chairs, a backsplash, fun items, functional items in the kitchen, the bathroom, gathering space, you know, et cetera, et cetera. But it's all, I'm extremely impressed. I'm really impressed because it's clear and apparent to me that these people have highly functional lives. It's, but not to the point of, it's not, you know, you can take analysis too far. You can analyze anything to death. I've been guilty of this. You can overanalyze, and in fact, it becomes non-functional. But you can be analytical enough to accomplish goals, at the same time weaving in your intuition, weaving in your aesthetic sensibility, and your own preference, and your own personality, your affect, your moods, how you're situated historically, culturally. So you have all these dimensions coming in that do come from the outside, and you're a part of it. You're a microcosm of it. And I'm particularly impressed with how some people make every decision, in not only in their living space, but their workspace, and it has a great meaning to it. There's everything has a place, and every place has a thing. And it's not, you don't have a junked up garage. This is another thing. We didn't mention this yet. A lot of homeowners in America in tract housing, they junk up their garages. You can go through. It would be a fun exercise, but a lot of people have garages they cannot park cars in anymore, or they've turned half their garage into storage space, so they can only park one car. And eventually, you have a storage facility in your own house, and people are blown away by the sheer number of items that they store in their garage. They pull it all out. They clean up their garage, structurize it a little bit, and they have this beautiful space. It could be just as simple as putting two vehicles in, you know, or more, right? It could be a lot more. And so there's that intentionality. So what would you say to people who resonate with what we're talking about today, Nasrita, what would you say to them if they say, wow, this resonates with me, and I want to be more intentional about my home space. I don't want to be oppressed by my stuff, but I want it to be beautiful. What would you say to these people, you know, that would help them in their own journey?
Well, I think, you know, I always think of this in my own journey, and who we are and what we think is really a reflection of how we can pass on our own ways of what we've learned through education to someone else. Every space that I've moved to, my immediate thought is that I want room that is inspirational, that I can create in, that inspires me to be more. And yet, every space that I've moved to, I start to get bogged down by having it look a certain way, but then there isn't any room for change. This space that holds intention, creativity, inspiration, everyone is different. And so to hold on to that thought means that you have to give up something in the process of your space, which means that you are at the forefront of other people's thoughts on your space. And this brings us back again of are we enough in ourselves? So people have to come into your house and they can see that you have tables set up that you're creating, and it may not look like the showroom. It may look like something where you have a space where you do puzzles, or you read, or you think, or you write, or you design, or you grow herbs, or you have something that is, you have a craft that you're working on, and that space may not reflect a showroom. It may not be the most beautiful space, but it holds an energy. And I would say to people, find out who you want to be. What do you want to grow in yourself? Because that is the area that you have to leave room for in a new space or in an old space to get rid of old things to create that energy that holds inspiration and intention. You can't have things that you had 10 years ago. You can't live exactly the same way if you want to be different. You have to create a change within your environment.
Right. What you're describing is the power that things hold over us and the power that the structure of our living environment has over us. It's extraordinarily powerful, not to be underestimated. For example, I'll personalize this show in our remaining minute and a half. I want to build a more functional and better writing area for myself in my future. That I'm super crystal clear, intentionally about it. I want to have a better writing space for my future, one that is more functional. And I need to think about what that is. You know what I mean? What will help me write better and more? And then to also have a secondary writing space, because I work well that way. I work well writing 2 and 3 books at a time. I work well having a 2 or 3 writing areas, a main writing area, but also more. And Dick, doesn't that right there, just listening to that, doesn't it go to show you that space, the furniture, structure, has such a powerful effect on the mind, on who we are? Now, we have 30 seconds. You want to make a parting comment?
The parting comment is not only to create space in your 30, home.
29?
What?
We're just about out of time.
Okay, then that's okay. I'm done.
Okay. Yeah, so just to let everybody know, we're on a timer, and we're just out of time. We've got 9 seconds left. Thanks to all of our listeners. We'll come back at you next week, and we wish you all a nice day.